Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 13th of August, these are our main stories. Flight check-in has been suspended at Hong Kong International Airport for a second consecutive day because of anti-government protests. The authorities in the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan have accused the former president, Almazbek Atambayev, of plotting a coup after last week's violence during his arrest. The sister of a high-profile jailed Saudi Arabian women's rights activist says she's been offered her freedom if she denies that she's been tortured. Also in this podcast, the 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg strikes a positive note as she prepares to set sail to the US on a zero-carbon yacht.
No one I knew cared about this, and I felt like I was the only one. And now I don't feel that anymore, because I see that there are so many who care about this.
That's all coming up, but we begin in Hong Kong, where for a second day in a row, there's complete chaos at Hong Kong International Airport after anti-government protesters converged on terminals, cancelling all remaining flights. The airport is one of Asia's busiest. Flights in and out were cancelled on Monday after thousands of demonstrators held a sit-in. Earlier on Tuesday, Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, said violence was pushing the city into an abyss and a path of no return. Ventus Lau, who helps coordinate the protests, told the BBC that calm could return to Hong Kong if the police stopped their heavy-handed tactics.
I think it is action and reaction only. When the police are being more and more brutal, then the protesters, of course, need to do some measure to protect ourselves. Because we can't only stay there and do nothing. Then the police will come to attack us. We have to take some measure to stop them marching close to us. But we are not intending to hurt the police or to do damage on anyone.
Our correspondent Stephen McDonnell is in Hong Kong.
Protesters in their thousands have returned to Hong Kong International Airport. They've changed their strategy there a bit. Over the last 5 days, there have been some form of sit-in, some form of occupation of the terminal. But initially, it was just people sitting down on the ground, handing out leaflets when passengers arrived, a bit of chanting and singing. Yesterday, there were so many protesters there filling both floors that it effectively shut down the terminal. Today, they went in there again, deliberately, I think, with the goal of disrupting it. So they've sat down in front of the area where you would go through with your boarding pass to clear customs to leave the country. Black-clad activists have placed themselves on the floor there, shutting down that process. All the check-in counters have closed again, outbound flights cancelled again. I think that I can't imagine the authorities tolerating this for much longer. The police must be not far off. Of course, it is a headache for them. They can't be going firing tear gas into the terminal of an international airport. You wouldn't think anyone who's been to that huge hub in Hong Kong will know what it's like there. There might be children, old people, people travelling from all over the world in that building. However, they could just go in there with just force from the police, and as has been the pattern, I think most of those protesters would scramble to get out of there pretty quickly because they've adopted a bit more of a hit-and-run strategy. So they'll go somewhere, they'll disrupt it, and when the police arrive, they'll take off very quickly. But this just shows, though, that this is deliberate disruption. I mean, Carrie Lam says that these people are disrupting the economy here in Hong Kong. Well, on that front, her and the activists have something in common. They would say, the hardliners, they would say, yeah, we are. That's now our intention. They think that's the only way they can bring this to a head. They think the peaceful path didn't work because with hundreds of thousands marching in the streets, this was dismissed very simply by Carrie Lam's administration. And so now they're upping the ante.
Stephen McDonnell. Chris Patten was Hong Kong's last British governor when the territory was handed back to Chinese control in 1997. He says unity is crucial to resolving the issue.
What's clearly needed is a process of reconciliation. It's the only way, I think, that you'll put a cap on this and get back to peace and stability in Hong Kong. Well, I very much hope that even after 10 weeks of this going on, the government and President Xi will actually see the sense in establishing a way of actually bringing people together and putting an end to what's been a miserable period in Hong Kong's history.
Chris Patton. The authorities in the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan have accused the former president, Almazbek Atambayev, of trying to organize a coup. They've charged him with murder, organizing mass unrest, and hostage-taking. Mr. Atambayev, who served from 2011 to 2017, was finally detained last week after a failed attempt to arrest him at his compound led to the death of one officer. Almaz Choroev is our correspondent in Bishkek.
The head of the security service of Kyrgyzstan became quite emotional as he told reporters why special forces were used to raid on the former president's fortified compound. He stated that special forces were actually used to protect the five police officers who came in to arrest Mr. Atambayev because he repeatedly refused police summons to testify as a witness about alleged abuse of office. Mr. Atambayev is actually facing quite serious charges now, especially charges on murder, taking hostages, and organizing mass unrest. The head of the special services stated that the former president was plotting a coup. That's why he wanted blood to be spilled. Actually, on the 7th of August, in the first attempt to arrest the former president, six soldiers were captured and one special forces soldier was killed.
Have we heard any reply from Mr. Atambayev?
There hasn't been any reply from Mr. Atambayev yet. However, previously he has denied all charges. We have spoken to Mr. Atambayev's lawyer before he was arrested. He has stated that Mr. Atambayev is feeling good. He is not signing any papers. And again, he's denying all charges.
Now, in Central Asian republics, it's not unusual for when someone falls out of favor, like Mr. Atambayev has, for supporters to drop off. Does he have any support at the moment?
That's again, many of the experts believe that Mr. Atambayev miscalculated his support. Actually, because during his tenure, he has criticized many politicians. He has actually put in prison many of his opponents. And for that reason, many majority of the experts believe that he does not have any support, especially from opponents and political politicians that are in power right now.
Almaz Choroev, one of the most high-profile women's rights activists who was detained in Saudi Arabia, has reportedly been offered her freedom if she agrees to say she wasn't tortured. Lujain Al-Hatloul's sister tweeted about the alleged deal, which Saudi officials deny. Our Middle East editor, Sebastian Usher, told me more.
It's a short tweet from Lina Al-Hathloul, one of Lujain's sisters, who has been advocating very strongly for her release. The whole family has been more outspoken than any of the others who are being detained. And she said, actually, quite interestingly, that she wasn't sure if she's doing the right thing in tweeting this and hoped that it wouldn't harm her sister, but saying she just couldn't keep it to herself. As you were saying, the deal being, say that you weren't tortured and we'll let you go. Now, this is standard practice in Saudi Arabia and other countries, that people who are being held on these sorts of charges are essentially told that they can be released if they promise to keep quiet. This has happened with quite a few other activists in the past, some of whom have now switched, in a sense, their allegiances and are now very much praising the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his changes. But what Lina finishes her tweet by saying is that she cannot go back on that. She wishes to verify once again that her sister, according to her, according to the family, according to some other sources, has been, in her words, brutally tortured and sexually threatened. This, of course, has been denied by the Saudis, but it's out there and it has raised very serious questions about the way Lujain's been treated.
And the other detained activists are currently part of an ongoing trial. How is that likely to play out?
Well, several of those who were on trial have been released, at least on a temporary basis. So there's been some movement. When they first appeared at their first hearing a couple of months ago, they didn't know what the charges were going to be. They didn't have proper legal representation. We still don't know quite where it's going, but there is perhaps a sense that the Saudis want an end to this. As you remember, just a week or two ago, the male guardianship system, which these activists were very strongly against, was ameliorated, let's say. So there is a move in that direction, and releasing these women would be part of that.
Sebastian Usher. A man has been arrested in Sydney after an incident in which a woman was stabbed and others were injured. Police confirmed the body of a second woman was also found inside an apartment building on the same street. Videos posted online show a man running through the streets brandishing a knife before members of the public helped to detain him. One of them, Paul O'Shaughnessy.
I think he had a balaclava on, jumped on a car, wielding the knife with blood on it. And we're like, wow, what is going on here? So we immediately, all of us went down the escalator and we just continued to chase the guy, where other people were just kind of like going away because obviously he's wielding a knife. Like, I don't know whether it's an instinct thing or what, but we was like, right, we just got to kind of try and restrain this guy from doing any more.
Paul O'Shaughnessy. For more, I spoke to our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer.
We know that three British men were working in an office block in the centre of Sydney when they heard a commotion down below. They opened the window to get some air in and they saw a man armed with a knife jumping on a car. They ran down to help, and there is very dramatic video of this alleged offender being pursued through the streets of Sydney. Eventually, he is apprehended by a group of men and he is pinned to the ground with a milk crate and a chair from a cafe until the authorities arrive. And the police here in Eastern Australia say that terrifying carnage was inflicted on the streets of Sydney today. And the actions of those bystanders, one of those bystanders, by the way, did confront this alleged offender with a wicker chair. And everyone from the New South Wales State Premier to the Australian Prime Minister have praised their bravery.
And what have the authorities said, if anything, so far about the alleged offender?
Well, he's been identified as a 21-year-old man by the name of Mert Ney. The authorities say that he had no known links to extremist organisations and that he was acting on his own. A senior police officer did say that a thumb drive linked to the alleged offender suggested that he had, quote, some ideologies in relation to terrorism. The police are continuing to investigate that side of the investigation. As far as the woman who was injured is concerned, she's still being treated in hospitals. So this investigation very much is continuing.
Phil Mercer. You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Still to come.
In recent months, a baby T-Rex sold on eBay for just under $3 million, and paleontologists protested that museums are being priced out, causing science to suffer.
Why scientists are concerned about the illegal and lucrative sale of dinosaur fossils to private buyers. A vaccine to protect people against the sexually transmitted infection chlamydia has passed initial safety tests during human trials here in the UK. Experts believe the vaccine may be the key to reducing infection rates for the disease across the globe. Abla Kla has more.
Chlamydia is the most common sexually transmitted bacterial infection worldwide. In 2016 alone, 127 million new cases of chlamydia were recorded by the World Health Organization. If untreated, the infection can have serious health implications for women, including pelvic inflammatory disease and infertility. For men, chlamydia can spread to the testicles, causing them to become painful and swollen. Researchers from the Imperial College London compared two different formulations of the vaccine alongside a placebo jab in 35 women. Both formulations appeared to be safe, but one stood out as more successful. The vaccine's first of its kind to be tested on humans. Professor Robin Shattuck from Imperial, who worked on the trials, hopes such a vaccine would give lifelong protection to those infected.
You can be treated for chlamydia, but that doesn't prevent you from being reinfected. And it's actually repeated cycles of reinfection that can cause the most damage. Now, ideally, a vaccine would give you lifelong immunity. We're not there yet. It's really still very much an early stage. The next stage is then to test it in what we call an efficacy trial to see if it actually reduces the rate of chlamydial infection.
Researchers say it will take years before the vaccine becomes available, but these initial steps hold promise for poorer countries which encounter major problems battling infectious diseases.
Ablakla with that report. Catering for aging populations is a challenge for most countries, none more so than Spain. It has one of the highest life expectancy rates in the world, and with social services stretched to the limits, there's a big dilemma about how to provide care for the elderly in rural areas where populations are in decline. One tiny Spanish village close to the border with Portugal in the province of Extremadura may have a solution. Ashish Sharma reports.
76-year-old Pio Ramos Perez demonstrates how the alarm on his mobile phone works. The call is picked up at the day centre here in Pescueza, and they ask him what help he needs. We are sitting in his allotment just outside the village. Pescueza has a total population of about 130 people, and most of the elderly residents have the alarm service. It gives Pio the confidence to move around, knowing that help is on hand if he needs it.
I was in a residence home for the elderly in another village and was there for 16 months. But despite the care, it was hard for me. This is my village, and I had all my friends here. So one day I called Raquel from the day centre and said I wanted to come back to my home, and now here I am.
Pescueza is a small village. The central plaza features one bar, a double-storey town hall and a 16th-century church. The rest of the village is a surprise of tiny, undulating, narrow streets, peppered with houses and trees, surrounded by garden allotments. It was here in 2011, a project named Stay With Us was started. Its aim is to provide the services needed by the elderly to enable them to continue living in their own homes. Constancio Rodriguez, president of the Association of Friends of Pescueza, was behind the project.
Two-thirds of the population of Pescueza is more than 65 years old. The success of this project is that the emphasis is on the small things that residents say are important to them, things that they ask for on a day-to-day basis. So if that means just having food, we provide food. If that means feeling protected, assured and not isolated, then we provide them those assurances. If it means having mobility with a vehicle, we provide them with transport so they can be mobile.
The population of rural areas in Spain means that almost half of the country's 8,000 municipalities have a population of less than 500 people. The majority of those are elderly. Dr. Diego Ramiro Fariñas from the Spanish National Research Council says social services gravitate towards larger populations.
I can tell you that rural areas in Spain, in these small villages, is more related to lack of services, lack of other facilities, supermarkets or like cultural activities or like a doctor or other kind of... And young couples, they move and they go away.
The Stay With Us project is funded between local and regional governments, but the residents also contribute depending on the services they use. So for lunch and dinner, plus access to the phone alarm service, Pio Ramos pays around $380 a month. Herminia Sanson Martin is 80 and still enjoys fishing in a nearby lake in Pescueza. She hopes that the services on offer will allow her to live out her days in the village she was born in.
They put in special walkways that allow us to get by, even when using frames or buggy cars so we can move about. They have services where, if you can't clean yourself, they'll visit you and give you a bath. Thankfully, I still don't need that kind of help, but some of the villagers do. And also, once a week, a cleaner comes by and spends 45 minutes to an hour cleaning your house. All this helps a lot.
Back inside the spacious day centre and some residents are watching TV in another room, a gym class is taking place. And with dinner to plan, the centre is a hive of activity. As social services face the dilemma of where to place limited resources, there is talk that Stay With Us could be a blueprint to roll out similar projects in other villages in the near future.
There you go.
Ashish Sharma, reporting from Extremadura in Spain. The 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg is preparing to sail across the Atlantic Ocean to reach New York. She'll be heading to the United Nations Climate Action Summit and is sailing there on board the Malizia 2, a special yacht fitted with solar panels and underwater turbines that produce electricity on board, making the journey a zero-carbon trip. The boat she's sailing on is owned by Pierre Casiraghi, who is the nephew of Prince Albert of Monaco. Greta Thunberg spoke to the BBC ahead of her voyage.
It is not our responsibility, teenagers and children, it is not our responsibility. And what we are doing now is to say that we demand that you take your responsibility and do something. I mean, our job is to demand solution, not to provide solutions.
Your first climate strike was almost exactly a year ago. How much have things changed, do you think, since then, since you sat outside the Swedish Parliament?
I think for me, everything has changed. I mean, but if you look at the bigger picture, of course, many things have changed. It's like, in many cases, the debate is shifting, and the debate climate has changed, and people seem to take this more urgently and they are more aware of it. But still, the emissions haven't gone down. The emissions of greenhouse gases global haven't gone down, and that is what we are trying to do. So before, I felt lonely, both because I have like Asperger's syndrome and I don't enjoy socializing, but also because it felt like I was the only one who cared about the climate and the ecological crisis. My parents didn't care about it, my classmates didn't care about it, my relative didn't care about this. I mean, no one I knew cared about this, and I felt like I was the only one. And now I don't feel that anymore, because I see that there are so many who care about this. It makes me feel good that I'm not the only one, and I'm not alone in this fight. And it feels like my life has gotten some kind of meaning lately, that I feel what I'm doing is meaningful.
The Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg speaking to Justin Rolat. The discovery of dinosaur fossils is exciting news for some of the world's biggest museums, but it's private buyers who are increasingly snapping up prehistoric remains online and at auctions. Scientists are concerned this illegal trade has now grown into a multi-million dollar industry, robbing museums and the public of valuable exhibits. Our reporter Beth Timmins has been investigating.
2006, 2008 here, at 2008 with the commission bidder.
You're hearing the auction of T-Rex teeth, Triceratops horns, and even the 66-million-year-old tail of a duck-billed dinosaur. Just some of the treasures up for sale at Christie's Auction House in St James's, the heart of London's art and antiquities market. But this for-profit fossil business is causing controversy. In recent months, a baby T-Rex sold on eBay for just under $3 million, and paleontologists protested that museums are being priced out, causing science to suffer. I've found a quiet corner of the sale room where James Hislop, head of science and natural history at Christie's, painted a picture for me of the sale's prized specimen, an ichthyosaur.
This 3.5-metre-long beast inhabited the oceans of the Age of the Dinosaurs. It looked like a dolphin and swam like a dolphin. Quite tragically, you can see between the rib cages the remains of two embryos. This is the largest and the best one that I have ever seen in my 12 years here at Christie's. Finding something this big really is quite unusual.
Bidders from Hungary to California join the auction, showing what hot property fossils have become.
I have sold fossil remains to every continent except Antarctica. There's quite often a painting portrayed of the evil Mr. X, who is a bit like a Bond villain, sitting on his dinosaur bones and never letting anyone else look at them. it couldn't be further from the truth. It just comes down to everyone's love of science. Everybody loves the dinosaurs.
I'm in London's Natural History Museum, staring at Sophie, one of the world's most complete stegosaurus skeletons. Dr. Susanna Maidman is a paleontologist from the museum's Earth Sciences Department.
Bones of stegosaurus are really, really rare. Before we had Sophie, we didn't even know how many bones there were in the backbone, how many plates there were on its back, and that prevents us from being able to understand how it lived. The problem is when specimens are in private hands, even though that individual might say, oh yes, come and study my specimen, as paleontologists, what we want to do is repeatable science. So we want specimens to remain in museums for hundreds and hundreds of years, forever. And of course, if specimens are owned by private individuals, there's no guarantee. Our acquisition budget for specimens across the entire museum, not just for paleontology, amounts to tens of thousands of pounds for the entire year. Now, some of these big dinosaur specimens will sell for well over $1 million. It's a little bit of a conflict because we don't have the resources to go out and find these specimens ourselves. We wouldn't know about them if commercial dealers weren't digging them up.
The US Customs and Border Protection's Office for Trade shared data with the BBC that showed that in the last 5 years, there have been 24 seizures of dinosaur fossils, amounting to a total domestic value of nearly $45 million. What is found of the lost world is rising in value, but as Dr. Maidman says, not accessing this information in the future could prevent us from being able to understand how dinosaurs like Sophie lived in the prehistoric past.
Beth Timmons. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.